Good morning. Before we start this morning, the court wishes to express its gratitude to Dylan Taxman, whose stentorian tones have just rolled out for the last time in our courtroom, at least until he assumes another identity. Dylan has been our bailiff for the past 2 years. Although he will not leave us until next month, this is his last case gaveling the court to order. He graduates from Georgetown in December, and after taking the bar, will head off to Fargo, North Dakota, where he will clerk for the Honorable Ralph Erickson of the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit. Good job, Dylan. Dylan holds a reserve commission in the Navy, as an ensign in the Navy, and has deferred his active service in the Judge Advocate General's Corps until the summer of 2020 following his clerkship. Dylan has performed his duties splendidly. We will miss his ebullient presence in the courthouse and wish him fair winds and following seas. Thank you. The case this morning, we have only one case this morning, and that is United States versus Tucker. Is the appellant ready to argue? The government?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Appellant may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, judges of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Tim Burrows. Major Julie Borchers is my co-counsel, and together we represent the appellant, Private Stephen M. Tucker. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes.
The Army Court's opinion cannot be reconciled with the jurisprudence of this court, the jurisprudence of the Supreme Court, or the guiding maxim of criminal law that wrongdoing must be conscious to be criminal. This court should reverse the opinion and reiterate that there is a mens rea requirement for Article 134 as a default that mens rea requirement is recklessness and not negligence. Now, the last time this court addressed this case, it remanded to the Army Court to review in light of Alanis versus United States and United States versus Havard. That raises three questions to answer. The first is whether the text of Article 134 is silent as to the subject of mens rea. It is. The second question is, in that silence, did Congress intend, nevertheless, to dispose of a mens rea requirement? No, it did not. The third question is, in the absence of clear congressional intent, what is the appropriate mens rea for offenses charged under Article 134? The answer is at least recklessness. Now, the Army Court got the first question right.
On that last point, it's not always at least recklessness. I mean, there are enumerated offenses for which negligence is a sufficient mens rea, such as negligent homicide or negligent discharge of a firearm.
Correct, Your Honor. I would submit that it is the starting point for our analysis. It is not the end of the analysis.
Well, you said at least recklessness, but I mean I think your argument really must be the default is recklessness, but it could be negligence.
Correct. And thank you for clarifying that point for me, Your Honor. The default is recklessness. There are times when it will be greater than recklessness. There are times when it will be less. Those times when it is a lesser standard are few and far between. As it is, the Army Court focused on two examples. You've mentioned them already, Your Honor. In my research, I can only find one other example, which is negligently failing to deliver the mail. Beyond that, in the 60-plus years of jurisprudence, this court has more often than not struck down efforts to criminalize negligent conduct when charged under Article 134. I don't see any to go through all the examples. They're in the brief, but I think they make it unmutably clear that the Army Court's approach to this issue is incorrect. It cannot be reconciled with the most recent case this court decided on the subject, United States versus Rapert, in which it, you know, affirmatively stated negligence would not be enough to sustain an allegation of communicating a threat charged under Article 134. And again, we look back to the earliest jurisprudence of this court. In the early 1950s, United States versus Greenwald, a very clear case in which the court said, unless we have clear statutory language or, and I quote, ancient custom, negligence will not be enough to sustain a conviction under Article 134. Now, the case law is clear, I believe. The policy is also clear behind this as well. Article 134 is an incredibly broad-reaching statute, and if we do not respect the limitations on it, which are those described in Parker v. Levy, essentially the bounds of military custom, the nature of our services and traditions, which have never called for negligence as the starting point for criminality. If we set those aside and we adopt the new standard, which the Army Court seems to believe is necessary, we would be running a lot of risks. We would be criminalizing many things that have historically never been subject to criminal sanction. The Army Court suggests that somehow this is necessary in order to maintain the good order and discipline and the standing of our services, but I submit that it is not.
Counsel, to what extent should this court focus on the concerns expressed by the Army CCA about granting commanders enough latitude where they can ensure that they can maintain good order and discipline within the armed forces?
Certainly those are abiding concerns for the military. They are important, and I do not diminish the importance that they deserve. However, the ultimate arbiter of that question is Congress, and Congress has already provided those authorities. It has done so through Article 92. It has done through several other provisions within the UCMJ that would punish negligent conduct, but they have done it the right way. They have expressly articulated that, or their intent has been so clear, as in the case of Article 92 when we look at the offense of dereliction of duty, that this court has long held that negligence was an appropriate mens rea. So I believe the code already addresses those concerns as a first matter. As a second matter, the question of negligence is oftentimes one of inadvertence or carelessness, not necessarily criminal intent. And oftentimes the other remedies at the disposal of commanders, administrative remedies, promotions, evaluations, reports of survey, flipples these days, there are a number of ways in which commanders can ensure that our servicemen and women act diligently. They don't always have to send them to confinement, however.
Counsel, could you address the point that the government makes at the end of its brief, which is that during the CARE inquiry, the appellant, through counsel, had made statements suggesting that, in fact, there was some recklessness, deliberate ignorance, such that this was perhaps, even though the military judge had focused on negligence, the statements would be sufficient to allow us to conclude that the appellant acted recklessly.
Your Honor, I have three responses for that. The first is that the colloquy between counsel and the military judge is not a substitute for the accused's plea. Counsel cannot waive those rights for the accused. The accused can only do so him or herself, and that has to be based on a knowing and voluntary waiver. And that gets to the second point. The military judge...
In that instance, if the standard was recklessness, would the military judge needed to have described for the accused the difference between recklessness and negligence?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
That which separated innocent from criminal conduct?
I believe so, Your Honor. It was important for the military judge to properly explain what the correct mental state is at the time of the alleged offense. If the military judge doesn't understand this, if counsel are confused about this, we can only conclude that Private Tucker was confused as well.
And that brings up a fundamental problem, which is he pled guilty. He pled guilty and got the benefit of a pretrial agreement. Presumably was explained to him. I don't know where you find fault with the care, substantive care inquiry or what.
I do, Your Honor, as my first point. My second point would be the offense as charged doesn't clearly articulate the right legal standard either. It says to unlawfully provide. In the context of something that is typically innocent, you know, providing alcohol to individuals, that doesn't adequately convey the mental standards that this court looked at in United States versus Haverty, where we have something ranging from strict liability to negligence to recklessness to knowledge and intent. It's unclear at best what unlawfully means in that context.
So is your point that negligently providing alcohol to a minor is not a crime? That's what he pleaded guilty to, and you can't plead guilty to something that isn't a crime?
That is, I think, a point as well, Your Honor. We focused on the nature of the care inquiry. We believe that this case can be resolved more easily on those grounds. But, yes, there's no support in our customs or traditions, as far as I can tell, that negligently providing alcohol to someone who's under 21 is a criminal offense. Now, if commanders disagree, they have options. They have Article 92. They can prescribe this clearly and explicitly as a general order or, you know, a lawful regulation. But in this case, no such authority existed. It apparently wasn't that important to this command to do so. And so in the absence of that effort to reshape our customs and our customary military law, if you will, we have to go with what our historical analysis has been. And this court has already conducted that analysis in United States versus Gifford. Yes, this was in the context of Article 92, but the underlying facts, the underlying review of our practices still holds in this case. And this court, I think, very clearly and appropriately acknowledged how the provision of alcohol to fellow soldiers is generally lawful. It's generally innocent. And therefore, if we were to punish it negligently, we would be straying from the Supreme Court's guidance in Alanis versus United States, rather that asks us to make sure we separate wrongful from innocent conduct. So with these points in mind, I submit that this court has all the jurisprudence it needs before it. Rapert and Gifford are adequate to already resolve this question, and I ask that it reverse the Army Court's opinion and reiterate what is a longstanding principle, that there is a mens rea requirement for Article 134, and as a default, that requirement is recklessness.
Or could we just say there can be negligent conduct that's criminalized under Article 134, but not this conduct?
That is a true statement, Your Honor. I think perhaps it may be helpful for the court to help practitioners understand what that context is. I would submit that the deciding factor is going to be custom. I believe Parker v. Levy provides us with that answer. And when we look at those three offenses in the past 60-some years of jurisprudence on the UCMJ that have been found to be adequate when relying on a negligence mens rea, they are uniquely tied to two things, to our military mission and heightened sense of danger. Negligent homicide, it speaks for itself. We're looking at the loss of life. When we discuss negligent discharge of a firearm, the gravity involved with firearms and their centrality to our role as service members is pretty clear as well. When it comes to the mail, well, that's important too if you've ever been deployed. So I think all three of those cases, the court was clear when upholding those offenses to emphasize their standing in our traditions, their grounding in military custom, and it may be helpful for future trial counsel as they ponder whether Article 134 is appropriate to have the guidance from this court on that subject.
Are you really mixing Jägermeister with Monster energy drink?
Your Honor, I don't recommend that combination.
That seems like that's criminal.
Yeah,
it ought to be.
Disgusting.
Certainly not in poor taste, in good taste, Your Honor. Pending any questions from the court?
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Catherine Parnell, and along with my co-counsel, Colonel Steve Haight, I represent the United States. This court should affirm this case for two reasons. First, because the Army Court properly applied Alanis when it determined that negligence plus the terminal elements of Article 134 are sufficient to distinguish wrongful from innocent conduct in this case. And secondly, because even if the Army Court erred, appellant's guilty plea was provident to recklessness. Article 134 is a flexible and variable statute that criminalizes not so much conduct, but the effect that that conduct has on good order and discipline and the reputation.
Counsel, is the government's position that any 134 offense has a mens rea of negligence?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, because you seem to be saying that up front. Okay,
no,
that's not the government's position.
No, Your Honor. The government's position is that in this case, negligence combined with article with prejudice to good order and discipline and service discredit was enough under these facts. However, when we look at Article 134, it covers a broad range of criminal misconduct that prejudices good order and discipline and discredits the service. And as we look at the enumerated Article 134 offenses, there is a range of mens rea available, ranging from negligence to, in some cases, one might imagine strict liability or even specific intent in the enumerated offenses. The discussion for Article 134 indicates that when we look at the statute, we look at the charged misconduct and then at the terminal elements to determine which facts meet Congress's intent with respect to conduct that prejudices good order and discipline or is service discrediting. In applying Alanis, the Army Court first looked to Article 134 to determine if it had an organic mens rea requirement, which it does not. Then it correctly looked at legislative history, at this court's precedent, at the relative judicial silence on the use of negligence as an Article 134 mens rea, especially when we look at neglect of a child, negligent homicide, negligent discharge of a firearm, and other cases of that like. Article 134, pursuant to Parker v. Levy, is a statute that is meant to help us hold soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines accountable for their behavior, for all disorders and neglects. It has a long-standing history in military law and has been applied broadly but specifically.
When we look in Parker v. Levy, I think they emphasized that the offense has to be related either to because it's a crime or because it's custom of the military. And so even if negligence could be the required mens rea, you still have to identify a custom or you have to show that it's service discrediting. Is there a custom in the military that providing alcohol to minors is a crime?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. However, Parker v. Levy also stands for the proposition that what you're looking for is a direct and palpable impact on military custom and discipline. In this case, what appellant pled to was an offense wherein on military property in a military barracks, surrounded by fellow soldiers who were underage, he introduced an intoxicant that later, as he pled, led to disruption within the unit, him being held back from deployment, a crime befalling a fellow soldier.
That language goes to the terminal element, right? Not to whether the offense, the act or the failure to act is itself against a crime or against custom of service.
Certainly, Your Honor.
Morphing two distinct lines of analysis.
Not necessarily, Your Honor. The government believes that when we look at the mens rea requirement of Article 134, particularly if you look at United States versus Davis and Sedinsky, what we're concerned about is certainly the actus reus, but more importantly, the effect that that actus reus has on the military service or on the individual unit. So we believe that...
Let's just look at the act.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there a custom of the service or anywhere else that giving alcohol to an underage person is a crime?
Not in this case, Your Honor. However, when we look...
Why isn't that the end of the inquiry?
Your Honor, that's not the end of the inquiry because the reason that the command chose to charge this was because of the effect that it had on the unit, which when we look at the purpose of Article 134 is meant to hold service...
Okay, I make really bad cookies, right? And I give them to everyone in the unit and... It really upsets them because it makes them sick to their stomach, right? So the effect has been palpable and direct and undermined their good order and discipline and their morale. Is my cookie baking a crime?
Arguably, Your Honor, that would be innocent conduct. What we're talking about here is a soldier who knew he was violating the law, who negligently failed to discern whether the people to whom he was providing Jaeger
right,
bombs...
All the people that I gave the cookies to got sick because they were gluten intolerant. And I kind of knew that. Or I could have found out, but I didn't. I mean, I'm just saying it kind of sounds like the same thing.
Your Honor, I disagree because I find it difficult to imagine that that conduct would actually have the direct and palpable effect on good order and discipline while the military service as Article 96 of the original Articles of War meant it. What Article 134 is meant to criminalize is when soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines behave in a way that is prejudicial to good order and discipline because it undermines cohesiveness, it undermines obedience, it disrupts the unit, it causes soldiers to distrust one another. These are the things we're concerned about. And Article 134 as a tool, as this court recognized in Sidinsky, is the kind of tool that you need to use when, for instance, a sailor elects.
I think you're missing the point of Parker versus Levy, right? Which is part of Parker versus Levy is that, you know, that yes, it has this flexible capability to aid commanders, right? But it's to be kept from being unduly vague and unduly flexible by us putting limits on it, by commanders and the lower courts putting limits on it so that it's restrained or confined to those things that are in fact criminal. Because otherwise, anything that a commander thought impacted good order and discipline, whether it was on its own a crime or not, under your theory, could be made criminal. Right? And I don't think that that's what Parker versus Levy stands for. Do you?
Your Honor, I believe that Parker versus Levy stands for the proposition that that direct and palpable impact on the military service, that prejudice to good order and discipline, and the number of facts that we see in those enumerated offenses under Article 134 are what give us the broader contours of how the statute is to be applied. However, when we look at Sidinsky, when we look at Davis, and other cases where we talk about what a reasonable enlisted person would understand to be prejudicial to good order and discipline, we still end up...
But that's that element, right? That's what defines that element, right? It doesn't answer the other question, right, which is whether the actus reus can therefore be a crime.
Yes, Your Honor. The Parker versus Levy analysis still applies, and the government believes that when we look at those acts, those disorders, those neglects, everything that was specified in the original article, it can include negligent acts. It doesn't include all of them. Only those that meet those two terminal elements.
Well, again, I'm not saying it can't include any negligent act. Our question is confined to the act that you are claiming is a crime because it's prejudicial to good order and discipline.
And how, in this particular case, was it prejudicial to good order and discipline, other than that a bunch of people got drunk?
Yes, Your Honor. I'll answer your questions in turn. First, the government's argument is not that providing alcohol to an underage person is always necessarily punishable under Article 134. But in this case, where appellant pled guilty, indicated that he had a duty to ascertain whether Private G, who was his eventual victim in this case, was of age to be drinking the alcohol provided. And then when we look at the stipulation of fact, where he did not bother to ask whether anybody at the party was 21, he brought the alcohol into a military installation. In the stipulation of fact, it's revealed that he went to buy alcohol because he was one of the only soldiers.
Well, wait a minute. It's not what he admits. It's the effect on good order and discipline. Yeah, I think where you're going into your recklessness point here, it seems to me. But a bunch of people getting drunk, or rather, that's inaccurate, this bunch of people getting drunk on this horrible mixture, on this day, what makes it different from any other similar event similarly situated in the armed forces of the United States?
Your Honor, I direct the court to the record at pages 44 and 45, where the military judge engages in a colloquy with the accused, where he talks about how he knew that providing the alcohol was against the law, that it led to a fellow soldier getting hurt, that it was likely to lead to additional misconduct in the unit, that it threatened the careers of the other soldiers around him if they had committed misconduct on that evening, that he was pulled from the deployment, that the investigation caused disruption in the unit, and that it was his responsibility as a soldier to uphold the law, and that is the purpose of serving in the armed forces.
Well, I mean, but those are anodyne.
So those are things that would make it criminal if it had been charged as reckless, right?
No, Your Honor, I was specifically referring to the prejudice in good order and discipline, as Chief Judge Stuckey asked. The facts that pertain to the recklessness include the fact that he did not bother to ask, even though he knew there was a substantial risk that the people around him were underage.
But when the military judge explained the elements of the offense, did he explain to him that that's what he needed to admit to for it to be a crime?
No, Your Honor, he did explain negligence, which, as the government contends, was...
So the fact that he might have pleaded to recklessness doesn't help you, isn't enough?
No, Your Honor, I was specifically addressing the prejudice to good order and discipline point, and I'm happy to address the recklessness in a moment. When we look at that negligence mens rea and why it is sufficient to separate innocent from wrongful conduct in this case, that's partially because we're in the context of a guilty plea, and partially because the accused, in his colloquy with the military judge, said that he had that specific duty to ascertain whether Private G was
engaged. What did the military judge explain to him he needed to do? What mens rea did the military judge explain to him he needed to do? Because I know that, for example, in the area of consensual sodomy, right, when it was not explained to the person who was pleading guilty to consensual sodomy, that unless it was in this, that, or the other circumstance, placing it within the Markham factors, mm-hmm. that the mere pleading to it was not sufficient because they needed to explain to him what separated criminal from non-criminal conduct.
Yes, Your Honor, and the military judge did explain a negligence mens rea and entered a colloquy both with the defense counsel and with the accused about whether his conduct actually reached that negligence standard or whether it could be criminalized.
So if we disagree with you that negligence is not the correct standard, right, and if that's what he explained to him was the standard, and he didn't explain to him the difference between negligence and recklessness, the fact that he pleaded to recklessness doesn't help you.
Unless, Your Honor, this court takes United States versus Jones, which is the case in which the military judge incorrectly explained a definition to an accused in a guilty plea, and the court still upheld it because of the discussion with the defense counsel and the defense on the record. We maintain that even if the appellant had been instructed as to recklessness, the facts already extant in the record are sufficient to sustain that conviction. But more importantly, when we look at Article 134 and what is necessary to separate innocent from wrongful conduct, Parker v. Levy and the special society that the military encompasses. The military is more than just government and lawgiver to soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines. It is also employer, landlord, and occupies a number of other functions. Looking at United States versus Sedensky, what we need in the military is the ability to criminalize misconduct under Article 134 that isn't enumerated. That's the entire point of the statute. When Sedensky did a backflip off of an aircraft carrier, we did not have a statute that specifically criminalized that conduct. We're looking for the next Sedensky. We have huffing, the use of salvia, the use of spice, child pornography before it was enumerated. All of these offenses are in a range that hasn't yet been legislated by Congress and hasn't been enumerated by the President. And so the flexibility of Article 134 is what we want to maintain. That includes a variety of...
But you could still have that covered by a commander through Article 92 in a general order, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, but...
So it's really not a situation where commanders are handcuffed in the way you're describing?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, but the difference between Article 92, which punishes a direct violation of a direct or general order, is on a different scale than Article 134, which can be used in non-judicial punishment and other ranges for smaller neglects.
They can use Article 92 at NJP.
Right. Yes.
They can have a general order saying no alcohol in the barracks whatsoever. They can have an order saying alcohol in the barracks, but you can't share it with anyone unless you've seen their ID. Right? I mean, they can do a lot of things. It's very flexible.
And can specifically state what the mens rea is. Could yes. specifically state in the general order that negligence is sufficient.
Yes, Your Honor, and in contrasting this particular case with Gifford, in Gifford, this court examined a general order from a commander that did not contain any mens rea requirement, and the question was whether that offense was strict liability. Certainly, a commander could specify a mens rea for an individual offense. However, Article 134 is a different beast entirely. It is meant, again, to punish and hold accountable all neglects and disorders that are not enumerated.
Well, we told when we remanded this thing, we told the Army Court, don't hang your hat on neglects. That's what they did the first time around. And we said, that won't do. So are you making that argument again?
No, Your Honor. I'm simply referring to the neglects that Article 134 is meant to punish in order to talk about the broad range of misconduct that's not enumerated. Not to make the same argument.
Well, there's a broad range of conduct that's not enumerated, and there's also a substantial presumption that you got to have mens rea unless you make it pretty clear in some other fashion, like titling the offense negligent homicide. So where does that leave us?
Your Honor, if under that strict analysis, we still have to look to the clear legislative history and to the intent of Congress when they drafted 134 before we can presume any...
Well, they drafted it in 1775, so tell me what the intent was.
Your Honor, when Congress initially drafted Article 134 as we know it now in that original UCMJ in the 1950s, what they were concerned about doing was giving commanders a broad range with which to hold soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines accountable for those things they had not yet enumerated.
But the way, counsel, you're interpreting that seems to ignore, as was raised earlier, Parker v. Levy. The Supreme Court specifically said this is not intended as carte blanche for military commanders to prosecute service members simply because it's a concern, there's a concern about good order and discipline. Now, it's unclear to me from your prior response how you can reconcile the approach you're taking now with the Supreme Court's holding in Parker v. Levy.
Your Honor, what I'm talking about is those disorders and neglects which are specifically prejudicial to good order and discipline. As Parker v. Levy said...
But in terms of the distribution of alcohol to minors, we have instances where the command will distribute. The command will distribute alcohol to minors. That's specifically authorized. So how can we look at the simple act of the distribution of alcohol to minors as being in and of itself something that goes to the heart of good order and discipline?
Your Honor, in this case, we're talking about the distribution of alcohol by this soldier to these minors under
Counsel,
these circumstances.
I think the thing that you are, and maybe I'm misreading the law, or maybe I'm misunderstanding the law, but I think you are, right, which is, yes, Article 134 is intended to be able to punish things that are prejudicial to good order and discipline or service discrediting, but not all things, things that are either A, criminal, right, or B, against the custom of the service, right? Because otherwise, commanders could pick and choose anything that someone did that they didn't like, that they saw as undermining good order and discipline or being service discrediting, and it could vary based on the person, right?
Yes,
you know,
sir.
Based on their personal beliefs, you know, oh my gosh, that's terrible, you know, and it is undermining good order and discipline, you know, Article 134 offense, right? And so it has to be tied to crime, or it has to be tied to being against the custom of the service. And as far as I know, including the reasons that Judge Olson said, giving alcohol to minors doesn't meet either of those criteria. No matter how much disorder and good order and discipline or service discrediting behavior resulted from it in this case, from him giving disgusting Jägermeister monster energy drinks to someone who turned out to be underage and ended up having sex with her without when she was too drunk to consent, right? I mean, so all those things are bad, 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 right? But that doesn't make it criminal.
Your Honor, the government does not argue that all of the universe of things could be punished under Article 134. Clearly, it can't be every mischievous act. It can't be every oops, every omission. That's not what the government's arguing. The government's arguing, pursuant to the discussion in Davis about the specific military context of 134, that it criminalizes under Clause 3 things that are illegal under other codes, and then under Clauses 1 and 2, the effect that conduct has on the military services. And so the government's argument is not that it is always a crime to provide alcohol to minors. It is that this soldier, under these circumstances and these facts, negligence was sufficient to separate innocent from wrongful conduct, and that his specific offense was prejudice to the good order and discipline of his unit. And the flexibility.
In other words, some other soldier providing equally repulsive drinks to a bunch of minors may not be the subject of criminal enforcement.
Exactly.
But do we have a notice?
I asked you this earlier, and you said. I said, what differentiates this from anybody else? You said, well, somebody got hurt, and this guy we lost this guy's services because we prosecuted him. Well, of course, the second one is a circular argument in the extreme. You chose to prosecute him, and you chose to lose his services as consequence. The first one may make is that the real thing that happened? If everybody had just sat around retching this stuff up and nothing more had happened, I can't tell what the commander would have done, but do you think this would have been prosecutable offense?
Your Honor, even Chief Judge, I see that my time has expired. May I
answer the question? You may answer the question.
So while I think the fact that Private G got hurt in this case is certainly part of the reason that the command elected to prosecute, that doesn't mean that they could not have done so under the same circumstances in Article 134, given the military location, the number of soldiers, the risk to those soldiers, the detriment to the unit, and everything else that appellant mentions in his guilty plea, which is why I raise it. With respect to Judge Olson's notice question, which I think he was about to ask, if we look at Parker v. Levy, and when they specifically overturned that Third Circuit opinion saying that 134 was constitutionally overbroad, one of the things they're talking about is that the enumerated articles give it context, but also under Sullivan, which is this court's precedent, and Hartwig, the idea of what's punishable under Article 134 is that which a reasonable enlisted person would understand is behavior to the prejudice of good order and discipline or a service discrediting. And therefore, the government maintains that in this case, under these circumstances, with this soldier, negligence was sufficient to separate innocent from wrongful conduct when combined with the effect on the unit as intended by Congress.
Thank you, Counselor.
Chief Judge, I do have one question. I hate to come in at the last minute here.
No, go ahead.
We've had a lot of discussion about the conduct at issue that's being punished under Article 134 and how it has to be criminal. And I'm thinking of some of the offenses enumerated in the manual. And I think one of them is wrongful cohabitation. And I'm curious of whether you have a view whether or not wrongfully cohabitating is a crime anywhere in the United States, some other foreign country.
Your Honor, I'm not currently aware of any law that criminalizes wrongful cohabitation. It's possible that that existed before, but Article 134 is meant to act in those spaces where there is no specific legislation. I'm not.
And in fact, that kind of conduct, wrongfully cohabitating can't be prosecuted unless it does have an effect on good order and discipline.
Correct, Your Honor.
That's all I have. Okay.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, sir.
Rebuttal?
I'd just like to make one point in reference to United States versus Sadinsky. That's a case that both the Army Court and Government Counsel have relied on heavily.
Is that the backflip?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. Okay. And it's important to look at how that offense was charged. Sadinsky was charged with wrongfully and unlawfully and through design doing a backflip off the USS Intrepid. In the court's decision, and I'm going to quote directly from it, that pleading flatly eliminates any possibility that the accused was pushed or slipped or that the incident otherwise resulted from misfortune, accident, or negligence. Sadinsky is inconsistent with the Army Court's perspective. It is inconsistent with the position that the government has taken. It makes it clear that negligence and the terminal element is generally not going to be enough. It certainly wasn't enough for Sadinsky, and it's not enough for Private Tucker.
Counsel, could you respond to the government's argument based on the Jones case that even a failure to accurately define an element would not prevent a guilty plea from being accepted if the accused comments suggested sufficiently that the element was satisfied?
That is not how I understand Jones. My understanding of Jones and Shell more broadly is that the crux of our inquiry is whether the accused understands the facts and the law and how those two things interact with each other. So it would not be sufficient for the accused to simply state facts that may satisfy the elements if the accused, as we're looking at the record, taking into account all relevant factors, was misled, misunderstood, or otherwise confused about the status of the law. They have to enunciate a clear understanding of how their plea relates to the facts. And in this case, it is challenging, to say it mildly, to imagine Private Tucker understanding the law when all of the licensed attorneys in his court-martial did not.
Thank you, counsel. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted, and the court is in recess pending further order of the court.
All rise. Court stands in recess pending further order of the court.